thyroid. Sashi, and then okay, three times.
And then the next one was one time.
Sashi, one. And then thyroid, three. Linda will help you if you forget it when the time comes. Sashi. Puki chip shing me to trum. Rira bling shing in dig and paddy. Sange shing do make tail wargi. Jokun amda shing la chipashu. Yidam guru radna mandala kam niryatayami. Chiram soki choknam la chamshu vaidu dakni kyapsuchi daki chanyen gipe sunam ki jola penchu sangye jupashu. Chiram soki choknam la chamshu vaidu dakni kyapsuchi daki chenyen gipe sunam ki jola penchu sangye jupasho. Churam soki choknam la chamshu vaidu dakni kyapsuchi daki chenyen gipe sunam ki jola penchu sangye jupasho. And coming into a meditation. And just relaxing into your physical form. In the sense that you're just giving up for now, running after something from the past or the future. And relaxing. Leisurely scanning down your body, starting at the crown of the head. Tension releasing as you go, merely by the power of your attention and awareness. Resisting the pull of other thoughts or sounds. Just staying with scanning the body until you've scanned all the way down to the soles of the feet and then scanning back up when you're ready. focus to the feeling of breath in the body. And if you can just observe, not try to change it. Your focus or your field of focus is broad and spacious, open. And you're focusing on the rhythm of the breath from that vantage point. Resist the urge to be heavy-handed with your focus, holding the object really tightly and with a lot of strength, relaxing the focus more, just so that your mind can be clear and bright. Find that balance between too much laxity and agitation. That's where the meditation becomes a lot more enjoyable. Cultivate the brightest, clearest attention that you can for the last few moments. And once you have that, releasing, expanding your focus into the full body, room and sounds around you. like that. Belinda, if you happen to know how to make this projector project green.
Oh, could you? I don't actually. I don't know much about it. You probably know more than
we tried restarting, but maybe just someone else's Chromex seat's involved in it will make a change. After 1 hour or something. It's okay. It doesn't. It's just nice. That's where I'll get to bed.
Oh, what's that? Oh, here it is.
What is it?
Projected.
What did you go to? Oh, settings?
It was popping up right here. You see this? Something was popping up here. Or right here.
Oh, that.
Or something.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But it went away. It's that sheet.
Oh.
Then you go to the This is the diamond light one, so then you go to I think just go to search in the settings where you just were, or in that little circle one on the, down on the left of the screen, the bottom left, and then in the search type in class. Yeah, I think it's that first one. Top one. Course A, class 3. Yay! And then if you press that, yeah, and then that key on the keyboard, press it again, and the next one over. Yeah, that's good. Cool. It's a mystery, that thing. All right, so we are on course 8, class 3. And it's Wednesday, May 9th. I think I'm recording. Yes. And we're talking about death and the realms of existence. So tonight we're going to talk about the lives of craving spirits and animals. So for review, what is the main text that we're studying from? Mm-hmm. And I believe this is the Tibetan. Do I remember? Chu Numpa Zu. That's, I could be mistaken though. The way I wrote it here, that's either death in the realms of existence or that's the Abhidharma Kosha in Tibetan. Oh no, I'm wrong. That's the death in the realms of existence, I think. So, death in the realms of existence is the Chu Nungpa Zu, and then the Abhidharma Kosha in Tibetan is Tarlam Selje. And who is the author of the Abhidharma Kosha?
Master Vasudeva.
Mm-hmm. And when do we think he was born? Or alive.
350 AD.
Mm-hmm. And what's Abhidharma Kosha in English? It's treasure house of higher knowledge. You know what?
That's the
Abhidharma Kosha is a treasure house of higher knowledge. But you know what? I think that Tarlam Salje is actually not Abhidharma Kosha in Tibetan.
Mm-hmm.
That is illumination or lamp on the path to freedom, which is the commentary. We went over this the last 2 weeks, but it's confusing this week for some reason. So, who is the commentary written by?
The first time.
Mm-hmm. And his name in Tibetan is Gyalwa Gendun Drup. The first Dalai Lama, a student of Jason Kapp. Victorious one. I think it's his given name, because the translation says that it means Dalai Lama, Gyalwa Gendun Drup. So maybe it's just like the honorific for the Dalai Lama. I'm guessing, but I don't think that's his given. Okay. Okay, so we're going to talk about Yidak. Say Yidak.
Yidak.
Yidak. And in Sanskrit, it's Preta, or English, craving spirit. And we're going to study craving spirits from Tenrim Chenmo. Say Tenrim Chenmo.
Tenrim Chenmo.
And this is by Geshe Drulumpa. Geshe Drulumpa. Around 1100 AD is when he was alive. And the Tenrim Chenmo is the great book on the steps of the teaching. We don't know his exact dates, but they know the dates of his teachers and his students, so it's just a guess of when he was alive. So this text is about 1,000 pages, and the Geshes in those days didn't write that much. So Geshe Drulumpa wrote this huge text of all the steps of the path, and it was really rare in that time, even in the days of Jason Kapa. So Jason Kapa, what are his dates?
1357 to 1418.
Mm-hmm. And he's the author of the Lamrim Chenmo, the great book on the steps of the path. So he wrote about 10,000 pages of commentary. 10,000. It's crazy. And the way they say that he was able to do this was because he was taking transmission directly from Dharabina.
Mm-hmm.
Close. Starts with an M. Manjushri. Yes. So he was taking transmission from Manjushri. And what Geshe Michael says in this class is if you read his writings, you can see that it makes sense that he would be. Because of the depth of the writing and the fact that it's 10,000 pages of commentary. Same amount. So what Lord Manjushri basically did was he took Geshe Drolumpa's book and he rearranged it and created the Lama Rinpoche. And in Buddhism, it's not considered a virtue to take something spiritual and change it. So there's just commentaries on them, like elaborating and getting into more detail for generation after generation. And the Ten Rim Chenmo was lost for a while, and Geshe Michael found it, and this is what this reading is from in this class.
Geshe Michael found it?
Mm-hmm. He's, well, I don't know exactly where he found it, but I know that it's one of his things that he thinks is really important. Is to preserve all the texts and find the ones that are lost, because over centuries, and since the Chinese invaded Tibet, a lot of the books were destroyed, or people smuggled them out, or that sort of thing. And I don't know, maybe they come from other places too, but this one, it was lost, and then he found it, and. So Geshe Michael does a lot of translating. So I'm guessing that he translated this one, but that's just a guess. So this text that Jigsaw Kapa used to write the best book ever written in Tibetan, that this is what he used, the Ten Rinpoche, to write the Lama Rinpoche. And so in this book by Geshe Drolumpa, says that there are four causes for birth as a craving spirit. There's one general cause and three specific causes. Or you could say attitude. And the general cause is doing the 10 bad deeds with medium strength. So medium strength, well, number one, what are the 10? What are the 10 bad deeds? The 10 non-virtues.
Killing. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I
shouldn't. 3. There's one more body.
6.
Mm-hmm. And then a few more of speech. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then the three of mind. Mm-hmm. Ill will. Mm-hmm. So those are the 10. And so medium strength would be neither premeditated nor light strength. Light strength would be an accident. So a very light strength would be if you broke your vows in very minor ways over a long period of time. And then a heavy would be if you premeditated and then you went and you killed a holy person, something like that. That would be heavy. So those 10 are a condensed version of a list of 84,000. So if those are the top 10, then we're basically doing them all the time, multiple times every day probably. And medium would be somewhere in between the two of light and heavy, which is the general cause to be born as a preta or a craving spirit. And then there's three very specific attitudes that can get you birth as a preta as well. So the first one, say Jimpa Namsam Majimpa. Jimpa Namsam Majimpa. And that's failing to give the three types of giving. So the first one is Sasim Ji Jimpa. second is Min-Jik-Pe Jinpa. And the third is Chuki Jinpa.
Chuki Jinpa.
Do you guys know the three types of giving? So they're basically material things, protection from fear, and Dharma teachings. And then a lot of times there's a fourth one in there, which is love, but here they're just talking about three. So the first one is the giving shelter, food, etc., basically giving what people need to live. The second is giving protection from harm, danger, or fear. I really like this idea. So you can, you know, by taking care of people or being a place of refuge, you're giving them protection from fear instead of them being fearful of you. Like you could even think of a flea or a bug walking across your arm. Like you give them protection from fear by not killing them or smashing them or, you know, like you take them off your arm gently with a piece of paper or something that's not going to hurt them. So that's the idea of doing protection from fear.
I have a problem. I mean, I do have problems with when I see a bug on me, you know, especially. There's been a lot of things that have happened. Where bugs have gotten on me, and because I was out in, you know, where there's a lot of bugs, and then there were these worms. I mean, I just felt so grossed out. I was like, and then sometimes I would just smash it, you know, not even thinking twice first, you know, about protecting it, and then it happened when I was meditating one time.
Oh.
There was a spider I felt crawling on me, and then I kind of like rubbed that, and then it got smashed.
Well, you've confessed now, so you can do purification, and then just, I think what helped me with it is, because I'm a lot better than I used to be. There's still times where I think I feel something on me, but I'm not sure. And part of me, I just decide I don't care, and I just, like, scratch it. Or, like, if there was a tiny bug on there, it would for sure be smashed. So it kind of, like, it used to be a lot worse. So when you start practicing with it, it'll just get less and less and less. And so now I don't, with most bugs, I don't dislike them anymore. Because I think of them as, like, wanting happiness just the same as we are. So if you just try different things and to work, like, wherever way you can kind of, like, get in there to drive a wedge between that thought and the action, you know? And it'll get better. Like, it won't be perfect at first, and all of us are killing many things daily, but on that level we can work with it and stop doing that. So it just takes time, especially I think, yeah, when you're meditating. There's a lot of times where I think there's something crawling on me and there's not when I'm meditating. And usually I think I can kind of tell if I know that there's not, but it feels like it, I just don't do anything. But yeah, it's a hard one.
And I was doing the purification thing, and I opened that book that Lama Elaine gave.
The Vajrasattva?
I couldn't read that thing, or it in the wording. So I read the English version. It's a read it.
That's okay. Things. Why is it? It's like the Tibetan. It's literally the Tibetan or the Sanskrit. It's not the transliteration like the English letters.
They they have the English and the other language, but I was like thinking I had to read the
the English.
Non-English one.
You don't have to.
Okay.
I think there's some power in reading the non-English one, and learning it. But then it's really good to learn the meaning of it too. So you can do either. If you're doing recitations, the non-English one, you'll be able to get into a rhythm. It'll go a lot faster. The English one will, it's like, I don't know, it's kind of more cumbersome or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. But either way, it's good. Yeah. So yeah, that one's hard. So giving protection from fear or harm or danger. That's what this one is. And then the C up there is giving Dharma teachings. And this is the highest kind of giving because it helps in all future lives. So it doesn't have to be formal, it's just any way that you're giving a Dharma teaching to someone else. Could just be in your actions or listening or anything. Could be any of those things.
Does that mean to a certain degree of giving anything? Or is it just a continuous, you know, like, oh, you could give this a few times?
Yes, you have to continue with it. Mm-hmm. Continuous. So whenever the chance comes up, you're doing these things. So this one is, so the general cause we're talking about is doing the 10 bad deeds to medium strength. So that's just generally. And now specifically number one is failing to give the 3 kinds of giving. So you have the opportunity and you don't.
What was that first one?
The first one was giving shelter, food, giving what people need to live.
How can you do that one?
If someone asks you for money or something, like a homeless person, or if you know they're hungry and you give them food, or you know that like your friend is having a tough month or something like that financially or something, and so you bring them over dinner or you buy them dinner. So it also says giving what people need to live, so you can. It could be anything. It could be like, you know, someone isn't warm enough when they're sleeping at night, so you give them a blanket. Or someone needs a place to stay, and you let them stay at your house, one of them shelter. So just any way that you can. And maybe more specifically, like not being stingy with our food or the things that we have and sharing it. So like even if you're with people and you know someone wants the last dessert and you want it too, you don't take it, you let them take it. And it really, it's like so there's gray areas because it's not like you give them anything they want or that they think they need. Like an alcoholic, you're not going to give them alcohol or something that's going to harm them. So we're not talking about that. But it's basically someone needs something and you have it and you just don't give it out of anger or laziness or possessiveness. It's like all the vows we went over. So laziness is in there. Possessiveness, anger. And then the second one is Sarna. Say Sarna. Concerna, which means stinginess or a cheapskate. Tightwad or miserliness. And this is the classic cause, not wanting to see your possessions become less. Having the misconception that what you have, that you have what you have by not giving it away. Because you don't. The only reason we have anything is by giving it away. This one's really cool to work with. I haven't been working with it in a while, but when I was focusing more on it, you could start to see that giving it is the only way that you ever got it, and so you want to give it. It gets to be different if you work with it a lot. Because I think the natural tendency with it is to feel like, if I give it, I don't have it. So what sense does that make, in a way? That's kind of what comes up, even though we know what sense it makes. So this one's really cool to work with. I like this one a lot. And then the third one, say Trakdok. Is jealousy. Wishing that others didn't have the good things that they have. And probably we do this all the time. And, you know, to one degree or another. So it's a, and it's really, for a Dharma student, it's really a sick attitude, because we're supposed to want everyone to be happy, and then we're opposite. We're doing the opposite, and we're upset because they get some crappy little thing in samsara that they're going to lose, and it's probably going to make them unhappy anyways. So it's really like, it's completely backwards. We're supposed to be looking out for all sentient beings. And then we're irritated when they have some little success or wealth. Or, and usually it's not even something that we would want. We just, it's just really sick.
Especially like social media.
Yeah.
Instagram
is like a hotbed of traffic. Yeah. And it's really, in our conventional way of thinking, it's really hard for us to see the connection between failing to give something because we feel possessive, and then when we're going to die, we're going to be born into this realm of the craving spirit, because we can't see it, and we can't really prove it. We can only prove it logically. And so it kind of sounds like a religion, you know, where you're saying there's a guy up in the sky and he's going to punish you. It has kind of that feel to it. So at this point, we're going to think about the 4 points of karma, or talk about them. Because I think you guys both took the karma course, right? So you know them, you already know them perfectly. And the essence of karma is the movement of the mind. So getting a sense of that karma is movement of the mind. So the movement leaves an impression on the mind stream, and then any time our mind goes from here to here, it's the essence of karma. Any time our mind shifts, it's a karma. Then what you say and what you do with your body are secondary. So the essence is when the mind just shifts a little bit. And a lot has to do with intentions, what we see and what we see ourselves doing. So when we perceive ourselves doing good or bad, it impresses the mind stream. And as we know, a good impression will bring good result, bad impression will bring bad result. So then, oh. Oh good, it's still there. So then the 4 principles of karma, as we know, the first one, say le nepa. The second, pel chewa. Third is ma jepa dang ma trepa. And then the fourth is jepa chu misawa. Okay. So the first one is fixed contents. Doing good yields a pleasurable result. Doing bad yields a painful result. And it is really tricky. We forget this constantly, because the good result comes at the same time as the bad deed that we do. So we do a bad deed, and then we get a good result, and we think that the good result came from the bad deed rather than a prior good deed. And we think this over and over all the time. So that's why it's good to hear it over and over, because each time it chips away a little bit at it. So it never goes this way. Nothing bad ever comes from something good at all. It does seem that way, though. So I lie to someone and I get the last piece of chocolate. Like I say, oh, I didn't have a piece yet, or something like that. And I get the piece of chocolate cake, which is a good thing, in my experience. So did the chocolate cake come from lying and saying I didn't have a piece yet? It really seems like it. It does really seem like it, because I just said, no, I didn't have a piece of chocolate cake yet, and they gave it to me. So it came right after it, so it seems like it came from it, but it didn't. It came from, you know, in a simple way, giving chocolate cake to someone else before. So lying is a bad deed. Getting chocolate cake's a good deed. They didn't come from each other. One did not cause the other. And we think things work this way. Otherwise, we would never tell a lie in our entire life if we didn't think so. I mean, there are some times where we kind of tell a lie before we even notice it happened, like we didn't even think about it. But a lot of times we know what we're doing, and we would never do that if we didn't believe that something good would come from doing something bad. So the lie will create dishonesty or some unhappiness in our future. And because the lie and the cake came in the same time frame, we really think they're connected, even though we've studied it so many times, so we just keep studying it again and again. And I think this seed is like a tree, or planting something is a brilliant analogy, because it's very clear that there's a gap between planting and the ripening. And so we can, maybe, I wonder if that's a good way to work with it. Think of like the good things that happen, or the bad things, anything is like a flower coming up or a tree coming up. Because we know, we get that came from something in the past. We don't think that you plant it and immediately it comes up. So it's like some negativity pops up. It's like a, you know, it's a flower coming up in spring, or a weed, or what, you know, whatever. So it's not, if everyone understood this, everyone would be happy and getting money and things that they wanted all the time. So that's the real tragedy of the way that we've been living for countless eons. Because it's not necessary that some people have to be poor and some people have to be rich. Everyone can be rich. There's not a finite number or amount of wealth in the world, because it's all karmic seeds. So intention is about 90% of the karmic seed, which is a lot. So if we just do it, if we just believe this, and be completely honest, we'll get big results. And we're not sacrificing much. We think that we are, and that things are going to go really bad or something like that if we start being really honest. And I mean, sometimes we're not going to get, well, maybe a lot of times we're not going to get the result right then that we want. But sometimes we will. It's a crapshoot anyways if we're trying to manipulate it in the present, because it's coming from the past. So whatever is going to come up, it's going to be coming up whether or not we lie. But do we want to plant that negative seed for the future? So practicing being completely honest.
I was just thinking about that, because I was worried. I was all paranoid about a situation at school, and this girl told me, oh, this person you, and I'm like freaking out because I missed a lot of hours, and I'm just gonna make 1600, and so then I was already immediately thinking in my mind, okay, I'm gonna have to save this and this to get out of this, and all of it's a lie, and then I was like, oh no, I can't. I don't want to do that because it's such a habit for me. It really was like a huge thing for me early in life and not too long ago. Yeah,
it's hard to break those really deep habits. And all of us are doing things like this. We just have different ones that are stronger. But we can, in a way, I think lying's kind of an easy one to change because we have to think about it most of the time. Like, you have to think up the lie. So it's like you have more time to work with it in a way. Whereas some other things, I mean, like wrong worldview, it's just there so much. Or killing, I mean, we can't stop doing that completely because there's all these organisms living in our body that we're killing, or animals that we're walking on all day, you know, tiny little bugs. So we can't completely stop that one. But lying, I think we can do. So I think it's a good one in that way. And then we don't have to worry about anything or, like, keeping our story straight.
I think, like, psychologically, too, like, it seems to be healthier for you, like, especially, like, if it's, like, quiet lies because you're afraid of hurting the other person. Like, for me, it's, like, made me practice, like, taking up space, kind of, like, in, like, having my own experience and not being apologetic. Like, you know, if I, like, missed class because I, like, felt depressed or, like, you know, instead of, like, saying something else, like being, like learning to be okay with like sharing what my actual experience was, and like seeing that like, oh, like I'm still in a relationship with this other person, it didn't like cause like the whole thing to blow up or something, like has been really helpful to me.
So you had the belief that if you shared what was really going on, your people weren't going to want to be around you because,
like,
they wouldn't like it or...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and most of the time what we think is going to happen never, ever happens. And we'll be planning for it and planning for it, and then it never comes. Or we'll be planning a lie, and then we never even have to use it. But we still planted these seeds just thinking about it, too.
Yeah. Or just in, like, work culture with, like, sick days, you know? Like, just kind of a culture of, like, not saying what it really is or coming up with, like, an appropriate lie.
Yeah. I know, I think that's an awkward thing at work. My manager now, she, like, there's never any asking why you need time off, which I think is how it should be at work. It's nobody's business what your time off is for. You have time off and you use it.
Yeah. What if you're using your sick leave?
You just use your sick leave. Like, I explained to her one the other day because I had, like, a bunch of different appointments, like doctor's appointments that came up kind of all at once, so I felt like I wanted to explain, but she never asked. And I don't...
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if she really wanted to know or not, you know? But yeah, I think that's how it should be. It's like, especially at work, it's your own business what you're doing. It's no one else's business. I mean, if you're like excited and you want to share, then, but...
Yeah.
I don't think that's culture usually, though. It's usually like I used to feel like I had to explain all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, we're on the second one. Pal Chewa, it gets bigger. The karmic seed gets bigger. So the results are bigger than their seed. Which this is comforting, I think, a lot of times, because when you see someone annoying or someone doing something really crappy, that comes from our karmic seed, but we were never that bad. So it was smaller what we did. So when someone's being really irritating, we can sometimes we think, I was never that irritating. And no, you weren't, because it grew. So it's kind of like, this is the example that's given in this class. So Geshe Michael lived in a Mongolian temple in New Jersey, and it's surrounded by these huge oak trees. And there was a storm, and one of them fell through the roof of the temple. And the Mongolian said to Geshe Michael, you get up there with a chainsaw and you fix it. And he was scared of heights, too. So he had to get up. I think he got up on the roof to cut the tree and, you know, I guess roll it off or whatever they're doing. And he was thinking, what if 40 years ago someone had taken that acorn and threw it on the asphalt? It wouldn't have grown, and there wouldn't be that tree. It would have fallen over, and he wouldn't have to be up on the roof. So the acorn is tiny, and then it grows into this big, huge tree. And it's the same, it's the same idea with us, too. We were born, or we were made from one cell of our mother, one from our father, infinitely small. And then we've grown. So it's kind of how the physical world works. And then the same thing happens with karma. And that makes sense, that description of it to me, too.
Does this work in all the realms? Like, in all the realms?
Karma?
Yeah.
From what I know, it works in all the realms that we're studying. Because it's a continuing, like your mental consciousness is continuing. I don't know if there's different worlds or universes where karmic laws work differently, because the laws of karma are empty as well. So it's not like they're set in stone, because karma is working in the cycle of suffering too. So when you're outside of suffering, you're not bound by those same, you're not bound by them in the same way, because karma is used to describe like the suffering seeds. And then enlightened beings have, I think it's just called merit. It's either called merit or white seeds, or they're just called seeds or something like that. But anyways, I don't know if it could be different in other different universes, or like, I kind of don't think so, but I don't know for sure. I don't think I've ever heard that question answered. So even the slightest thought that we have becomes a huge result. So, in a sense, karma is really volatile. It grows really fast. So then number three, if you don't do a karma, you won't get a result. So if you throw the acorn out on the asphalt, you'll never get the tree as a result. If you avoid a bad deed, you'll never get the result of the bad deed. If you don't ever plant the seed for something really good that you want, it'll never ripen. And then the last one, if you do a karma, it'll never just go away. So it'll always ripen. It's planted in your mind stream. Well, I don't know if that's true, but it'll always ripen. But it's planted in your mind stream, and it can go on for thousands of years. It replicates itself, it's destroyed by the instant, and the energy is transferred to the next instant. So over and over and over and over, like all changing things. So,
I was going to ask you.
So you see someone who needs something really bad. There's nothing to prevent you from giving it, and you're just really stingy. So you're seeing yourself doing that. You're perceiving yourself not giving to them. You think about it and you decide not to give to them whatever they're asking for. And then that's planting a karmic seed that's going to grow. It's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So they're just really small things that slip by every day. But we're aware of ourselves at that moment, which plants the seed. And then it flowers as a perception that we don't have enough money, or we don't have what we need, or we don't have enough friends, or whatever it is. So in an extreme form, not giving causes the perception of ourselves as a prajna, of being overwhelmed with wanting and not being able to find anything. So that's how it would get there. So you have this craving for more and more, and you can never be satisfied. So by planting perceptual seeds of not giving, those seeds grow extremely large and powerful and expand. And then not giving plants a seed that grows and causes our perception to become such that we see ourselves as a craving spirit. So this is, it's just how the process works. It's not that anyone's doing it to us. And it can happen to us if we perceive ourselves doing one of these causes, and then our perception shifts and we see ourselves as a craving spirit. What was your question?
So you said it's definitely, but that's just if you don't cleanse or purify it.
It never just goes away. So I think there's a big debate on this, but the idea that I've heard the most is that the seed is damaged, and it, like, it's damaged beyond repair, so it won't ripen, but I don't think that it's completely destroyed from what I've heard. But then I think there's a debate on it, and I don't know how the debate goes. So I guess, is there really any difference in one way of it being destroyed or never ripening? It's kind of the same. It's not the same thing, but the result's kind of the same thing. It never ripens.
When I was reading Mama Christie's book, and she had this meditation about going back and seeing yourself do something different. Is that kind of a purification practice, or can't remember what?
I think you can do that as part of the four powers. So that could be your makeup activity, is going back and seeing yourself doing it differently. Technically, if it's just on its own, is it a purification? I don't know for sure. It seems like it. But I know for sure if you made it as part of the four powers, it would be. Yeah, if it's like your makeup activity.
And then you also, well, I guess there's a sense of when you think about, oh, everything's empty. You just kind of get this feeling. Like, you know, when you're talking and then you find yourself doing things against, saying things, kind of going against what emptiness is, in a way.
What's an example of what you would be saying?
Like, when you label, when you're, like, saying, when you're talking about an experience that you had, and you're the right words to not kind of, because I kind of almost feel like if I'm saying a certain thing and saying, like, this made me feel, this experience was this,
embellish it.
Or
the imprint that feels stronger. Because you're like focusing on a certain part of the experience or something. Mm-hmm. And then talking about it with someone and like in your mind now it's really strong, like that was that way.
So it's like you're solidifying the experience and making it more real or something?
Yeah. And then there's like
are you saying, like, sometimes it feels like because everything's empty of self-existence that it's like, what am I even talking about? Why am I even saying this? Or kind of because you're making it up in a way, or...
Yeah. Like, is it even real?
You're trying to fit it into a certain category or a certain box or something like that. Well, I mean, just because it's not self-existent doesn't mean that it's not real. So you're definitely having an experience and something is happening, but I mean, the label that you're placing on it is ambiguous, in a sense, because just in a very basic way, because there's all different language, like, there's different languages. So you're placing, like, one label from English on an experience, and someone who speaks another language would place another label on that, or, you know, different beings would experience the same thing different ways. So it's not that it's not real. It's no less real than it was before we knew about emptiness. It is real in a way that we're experiencing it and we're having, you know, things are happening. And it's good that we have labels that we can all agree on so that we can communicate and talk about it. But I think I know what you mean. Where it's like you're trying to.
I feel like the more I engage in it, the less I'm coming close to even seeing it. Mm. You know?
Because you're out of the experience and you're just trying to intellectualize it or something like that.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I've had like long conversations with friends about things that have happened, and like you make up this whole story about why it happened and what happened. So you are like, we are adding on all of this fiction, complete fiction. Like, oh, I bet they thought this when they did that, and that's why they did it. Because we really only know our own experience. I don't know. I don't think I'm really getting what you're saying at the heart of it.
So I come up with a clear, like, way of even...
Yeah, it's hard to verbalize our experience, especially when it's like we're... Like, I had the experience, but I don't totally get... Or I haven't thought about it enough where I can... explain it that clearly that, you know, that happens to me too. Yeah. Okay, well, let's take a break. And if you think of what you're, well, I know I tend to think that I have to, And you don't have to. You just like relax and soften, and that'll change it, number one. And then you just let the energy move through and do whatever it needs to do. So I think that's really good. That helped me a lot in retreat.
How can you just you keep wanting to attach to it in some way?
So you just keep relaxing over and over, like physically and your mind. I've been finding lately it's so helpful because the idea, just like just to let go of it, that one's hard for me because I feel like, no, I have to like do something. I have to interact with it in some way. But what I've been doing instead is like just noticing more and more when my emotions are really high that I just say, I'm going to leave this for now, and if I want to, I'll come back later. Mm-hmm. And that's been really helpful. So, like, I'm leaving the intellectual circling, and, like, the feeling's probably still there a little bit, but it dissipates really quickly without the thoughts spurring it on, too.
Everything about them. And just, so do you just avoid the teaching?
Well, I guess it depends on what your experience is, but I definitely have had this. And I think the most helpful thing that I've done is just to completely change your mind. So, to go to the teaching where think and look at this person as like, okay, maybe my lama's not here right now, but they're teaching through this person. So that's my lama teaching me right now. And that'll usually shift it. So trying to see them that way, and then you can think of all those annoyances. What are they, like, they're teaching me this right now to point something out to me, and what is it? And so looking at it like that's like the holiest teacher I can think of sitting up there. Every time a teacher is sitting, teaching, thinking that, because, well, number one, we don't know that it's not true. Like, if we have the karmic seeds to see it that way, it will be that way. And it's possible that it is that way, and we just don't realize. So whoever is sitting up and teaching, it's not necessarily like they have some great power, but it's also not necessary that they don't have some great power too. And it might just be that they're like a, they're like channeling your teacher for you in some way, something that you need to hear. It's not like they're trying, maybe. Or maybe it really is your teacher and they're just showing themselves in a different form. Yeah. So you hadn't seen this teacher before then?
I had known nothing about them, and then a husband and wife, and they were Tibetan.
They were Tibetan?
Buddhists.
Oh.
Yeah. But they were, from here. And then, pretty much just stuck to like the surface level of talking about Tibetan Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you're having like anger coming up because you like learned more and you wanted to hear deeper teachings or
something different, but there were people that were so into it, and like they were like, this one lady in the end was like, let's talk about bringing them back next year, and I'm like, oh no. But I kept trying to to do that. Like, I kept trying to stay open-minded, just stay trying to open your mind to this. And then it's just, and it got so intense that I was just like, and then they had these group meetings that were, you know, you signed up for one at different times, and they would be group, and you would ask questions, and then I went to two of them. One day I went to one, the next day I went to another, and then the third day I was like, no, no, like, I'm not going. It was horrible.
Well, I think it's really good to be doing retreat and to, like, be going through those feelings. And maybe, probably next time, look into them more before you go. Because it is really hard to, it doesn't mean that it wasn't right for you to be there, because it was, or you wouldn't have been there. But it does make it really hard if you're fine. Finding your teachers really annoying, like, for the whole retreat. I mean, so that is a, you know, a difficult thing to deal with.
Because I had went to, it was the, I went to it last, or two years ago, at the same, you know, they have it every year.
Yeah.
It was so amazing. I was just expecting this amazing thing.
Yeah.
And then everything just fell apart. Like, someone wasn't there that I thought might be there, but then, you know, and then I was just like, okay, just let that go. It's gonna be okay. So, yeah, it was just not what I expected. And it's, I mean, and I feel like I came out of there and I was like, just go on the first retreat. It almost, I tried to stay in silence that the day coming back, and then the next day as much as I could, and then
yeah, it sounds challenging. I think what Ami usually says is, if she doesn't have some huge challenge in retreat, she thinks that it's a waste. Mm-hmm. She feels like she's just, like, wasted her time. Mm-hmm. So, that's what I've been taught from her many times, is that those are, like, the really fruitful retreats. And you never know which way it's going to go. There's going to be ones like that, and then there's going to be ones that are really smooth sailing. And at a certain point, you might not like the ones that are smooth sailing. You might start thinking the way she's explained, where you're like, well, nothing even came up. Like, that was a waste. But it's not. So it's okay. Then you just have, like, different, next time you'll have different skills and new things that you can work with, you know? Yeah. Okay, so now, let's see, okay, I think we're fine. Now, the three kinds of pretas. The first one, say, Chi Drupa Chen.
Chi Drupa Chen.
And that, and those are beings with obstacles on the outside. So the things outside of you are a problem. They have this incredible craving for something to drink, and they can't drink anything. They see a lake of beautiful water, and then they run up to it, and when they get there, they realize it's turned to blood and pus. So, really torturous existence. Their minds shift, and then as they approach it, it's turned into something else. So your mind is shifting. And I think in a way we get a sense of this, because we miss see things all the time. All the time when I'm driving, I see, like, a leaf and I think it's an animal, or, you know, we see things out of the corner of our eye, we think it's one thing and it's not. So we can get a sense how the karmic seeds could shift in that way. So everything changes in our world to this, and the sun coming up is the same thing. It's a shift in our projection or in our perception. And it explains how being can walk up to some water that they think it's water, and it's actually something disgusting. So it's our perception of things look very appealing from far, which is a good karma ripening, and then when you get close, the perception shifts and it becomes something repulsive. And then the second one, say, Namgi Drepa Chen. Namgi Drepa Chen. So these are beings with obstacles on the inside. So they have mouths the size of a pinhead, and their throat is the size of a guitar string, and their stomach is really large. So they can't get enough food to ever be satisfied. It just sounds like torture. So when we see these beings on the Wheel of Life, we think it's just a folk tradition. But it isn't like that. It's really the natural karmic evolution of constantly feeling feelings of possessiveness in this life. And most of us, no matter how much we get, we still want it more. So this is most of us. So it's getting used to saying, like, I have enough and everything I have is great. And the third kind, say, Sekom Gi Drepa Chen. So these are obstacles to food and drink. And when they get something to eat that's not nasty appearing, it burns them on the way down and in their stomach. So it's like drinking molten steel. And if it gets down, it'll never satisfy them. I know. The pretas can be any size, and they can reside either below the earth, a certain distance from the planet, or among us. A preta grows from a perception of ourself not giving, or being stingy or jealous, like we talked about. Then the seed expands, and we see ourselves not having or being able to get enough in any way.
And we can't see.
Right. Not that I've ever heard of. But I think there's some way where you give the offering at the end of your meal and you can kind of feel them. Because when you say Akaro, the idea is that for about 20 seconds they can get some sort of nutrient out of whatever you're offering. And you can kind of get a sense that they're there if you do it long enough. Like energy, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to think of that word.
Mm-hmm.
I think I thought of it when I was on a retreat and I was like trying to say what I thought it was.
Yeah. You just leave like a little bit
on
your last few bites on your plate, and then you say Akaro and you wait about 20 seconds for
Akaro.
Akaro.
Mm-hmm. And that's it, you don't say like in a big prayer.
You could if you wanted to.
And then you don't eat it.
Right. You don't eat it. And a lot of times, I think we talked about this, I mentioned this, a lot of times someone that you're eating with will be like, oh, you're not going to eat that, and they'll eat it. And I kind of think like, after I've already offered it, I kind of feel like it's fine.
Okay.
So, you know, like for a while I would say, because Mike would always do that, and I was like, that's my offering. And then he would eat it. And then it's so funny because and then he'd give me a hard time sometimes about not offering. He's like, if you really like something, you don't leave the offering. And when you don't like it as much, you do leave the offering. And then sometimes he says, eat everything. I'm like, no, it's my offering. It's funny.
Like you're on your toes.
Yeah.
Did he say it tasted good? The time?
He didn't say anything. No, there's not one time. He's done it many times. Yeah. Yeah. So, a day in the life of a preta, this is how long they live. A day in their life is a month for a human being. So, 500 days is the maximum that they would live, which would be 15,000 days in our days. And then they die again. So, I don't know. Is there is it 374 in a year?
365.
So, like 4,000, right?
Oh.
Oh my gosh. Then they just come back alive.
Because if you round it up to 4 and divide into 15, mm-hmm. Like you say it's 4, and you add the 3 zeros.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a long time.
And then they come back again.
And then they die again. I don't know if they...
Because they could be reborn or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do they collect merit?
I don't know. I'm not sure if it would be merit from that lifetime. So, I don't know. Maybe they, like, take care of other pretas or... I know. Maybe they do nice things for other beings in that realm. I don't really know. So there's pretas running around us and we can't see them. So that's why we make offerings to them. Because they are there, which we already talked about.
Is that like when people report like ghosts? Like with ghosts and pretas?
I think that there's also spirits, at least in the Tibetan teachings that I've heard. There's also spirits, and I believe that's what they would be reporting, but it could be pretas, but I've never heard that pretas are, like, mischievous or, like, causing any trouble or, you know, they're probably just suffering too much to have that thought. Or, you know, that inclination. But I don't know for sure. But I've never heard it stated that, you know, the pretas are causing trouble. It's always like the spirits.
Okay.
And I don't know that they're not included in that category, but that's never been my impression.
Okay.
So, this whole chapter is very unpopular. But the point is that because it's a mental perception, it's very plausible that it could happen to us, and so that's why we want to not do the things that would cause it. So we're just getting deeper and deeper reasonings why we need to be generous, you know, not jealous, all these things. And so it's just like an acorn that's planted. If it had some genetic flaw, it could grow into this huge, grotesque tree or some horrible result. And that's like what would happen if we planted the seeds for that preta type of birth. So if the mind is eternal, and it is, we've proved that in previous classes, if you plant a tiny defective seed, it's possible in like 2090 that it comes out as this horrible result. So we would have that seed flower, and we would look down, and we'd have a totally different kind of body. So basically, we don't want to be stingy or jealous. And if we practice that, we'll get very good at it. And we'll actually feel the seed being planted in our mind, and we'll have a deep regret about it when we do those things. And then, let's see, next slide.
When you're
feeling
like you're having that,
being not stingy or jealous.
It seems to me like things keep coming to me to give me the opportunity to do something, but then some things I feel real difficulty with
giving
with certain people, especially. Like, this classmate, oh my god, I can't, like, I had told her that I had these 3 hand sanitizers that we needed for state board, but it didn't come with the top that we needed, so you have to put on your own top, if it fits. And then she's like, and then she had told me she was going to give me this hand, she has told me, she's gonna give me these things, and she never does. And that hand sanitizer was from Dollar Tree, small one. And I'm resistant to giving that thing. I'm like, you, because of her. I think you got that's the right thing, but it's not.
Because you don't want to do something nice for her because you feel like she didn't do something nice for you.
Yeah. She kind of, she has, you know, but then I'm like, maybe now I'm like, oh, she's done all these things where I'm just so resistant to her. Now I'm just like, no, I don't care about you. And why should I? But then, you know, you see your these things.
Yeah, I know. It can be hard with some people. But you know why you would give it. It's just a strong resistance coming up.
And I have an extra top. But it's to my itch, you know, and I'm like, no.
Well, I think if you can... In a way, it has nothing to do with her. You're planting a seed for the future. So maybe there's a way where you can think about it. Because I think it sounds like you could do it. If it's something that's too abrasive and it's just too big, maybe you can't do it yet. But I think it sounds like you can.
I like thinking of her as like your only child.
Like maybe she was your only child in a past life too, or yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or like it's easier for me to empathize if I know a little bit about like her life story or something.
Yeah.
You know, if I have a sense of like of how she's struggling, then it quickly changes it for me or something. Mm-hmm. Like I have a story in my head about how. You know, like, I am not focused on their struggle. I focus on how they're, like, I don't like
them. Yeah. And it sounds like the crux of it is that you think that she purposely didn't give you those things when she said she was going to. But you don't know that. It could just be that she completely forgot about it. Or like, she remembers, and then when she gets there, she forgets. Like, I do that. Like, I think about, oh, I have to do that when I get to work, and then I forget about it. So it might not be at all what you're thinking of it as, too, in that sense.
I know.
So, you know.
Yeah, she smells
Yeah, so it could be that she forgets.
Yeah.
Or it could be she doesn't even remember saying that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if she was high when she told you. She was stoned when she told you.
The other day, though, she came up to me and was like, oh, Cheryl, weren't you supposed to give me your hand sanitizer? And wasn't I supposed to trade you something? And I'm like, how could you forget? And then I told her, and I'm still, you know, just like, oh, whatever. And then I'm like, I slip into this, oh, whatever. Like, why should I? Why should I care? But then I know that that's going to get me something, too. So.
Or maybe, like, saying something, like, speaking to the need, like, and the feeling, you know? Because, like, it sounds like there's, like, a resentment. Like,
yeah.
If you were just clear with, like, if you said something clearly, I don't know. And then, like, gave her the opportunity to, like, say whatever, like, her experience of it was. Then mm-hmm. maybe you wouldn't feel like you have to, like, kind of tune her out or something.
Mm-hmm. Let's see where we are here. Okay. Okay, so we're on animals. I know. Have you guys seen these videos?
No.
Oh my god, they're so cute. I just didn't want to, like, this is how we picture the animal realm. It's not really like this, but. So, animals, to be born as an animal, the general cause is doing the 10 bad deeds to a lesser extent. And the specific causes are number one. So, a lesser extent, we went over it a little bit before, but it's accidentally or infrequently doing the 10 non-virtues or the 10 bad deeds, and that'll lead to a rebirth as an animal. So we killed an insect by accident. We lied, but with no intention behind it and not about something really important, but we do it over and over. So that would be the lesser extent. Like you tell little white lies over and over. And we talked about this before, but we think of animals as very cute and they're having this great life. But in the Buddhist world, it's not like that. It's a life of constant terror. You're just constantly looking over your shoulder, never at ease, thinking that something bigger is going to eat you or harm you. Constantly watchful. And then there's this small category that's used by a man, like this little animal. I mean, he kind of looks like he enjoys it, but who knows? So, and this is kind of amazing. This is probably an old statistic, but in the human body alone, there's 80,000 species living. And there are 360 million species living on the planet, according to the scriptures. So the specific causes to be born as an animal are consistently breaking minor rules and disrespecting others. I know. And then, isn't he so cute? And then this is where animals live. Number one, Jingnamepa. In the ocean, where the vast majority of animals live, is in the ocean. And then Katorwa, which is spread out all over the place. So in the sky, in the waters, on the land, under the dirt. Pretas have their own place. Hell beings have a specific place that they live. And then the animal realm is spread out over all these. And every planet that has life has all these six realms. And we talked about this before, but people read the Abhidharma Kosha and they say that it's just some weird idea of how the world is. But the point is that if the teachings on emptiness and karma are true, that it's totally plausible and possible that we've been born in all of these realms and that we could be born in them again after we die. So the same way that we see ourselves now, we could look down and we would see pause. So it could be like that. And it, according to the teachings, it has been many countless times before. So that's why we practice, so we can get out of the cycle of suffering in this lifetime, and at the very least, not have lower rebirth. Oh, it's okay. This is the last one. Okay. We're finishing on time somehow. I guess we started late too. Do you know that Sashi and then Gewa? Yeah. One Sashi, one Gewa. Puki Shushi Mito Chan Rira Blim Shi Nende Gampadi Sange Shindu Mekte Uwagi Jokun Namda Shingla Chupasho Yidam Guru Radna Mando Kam Niyatayami Tikewo Ku Sunam Yeshe Sokshi Sunam.